Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Alice Robinson and Meg Mundell. Alice Robinson is the author of Anchor Point, longlisted for the Stella Prize and the Indie Book Awards in 2015, and The Glad Shout, shortlisted for an Aurelius. Aurelius? Aurelia? What do you think?
Aurelius, Kate? I think.
Aurelius Award, and winner of the Readings Prize for New Australian Fiction in 2019. She has a PhD by research in creative writing, for which she was awarded the Vice Chancellor's Award for Research and Research Training at Victoria University in 2012.
Meg Mundell is a Melbourne-based author, journalist and researcher. Her books include two critically acclaimed novels, The Trespassers in 2019 and Black Glass in 2011, a short story collection, Things I Did for Money, and We Are Here, Stories of Home, Place and Belonging, which is an edited collection of true stories by people who've experienced homelessness. And both The Glad Shout and The Trespassers have been shortlisted for a 2020, I just realised I'm going to say Aurelius Award. The best science fiction novel. It is confusing.
I feel like something in there should be a silent letter.
It we should totally have written it
out
should.
Phonetically. Sometimes I do that. Do you do a phonetic write out sometimes? If you
well, sometimes it's only as I'm sitting down to speak to you that I realize I have no idea how to pronounce something. It's very embarrassing.
That's a very well known award, though, isn't it? That
it's great.
That award
it has
with a difficult name.
It has. It also tends to have an extraordinarily big long list. It's in all these amazing different categories. So people are, you know, there's short stories and there's for young people and then there's graphic novels. And so, yeah, I think it's a fun one. I always look out for it.
That's fun.
I thought this is a really timely conversation.
Oh my God. So timely.
For the fact, and they describe this, that both of their novels have been described quite rightly as very prescient, but
I had
also
to look that word up.
You had to look
had to
it up.
That up. For listeners who do not know what prescience is, it is foreknowledge or knowledge of an event before it occurs.
It is.
You already knew that, I know.
I already knew that because I'm having to answer a lot of questions about the mother fault and prescience. But also that I think, you know, we've had a lot of conversations in this series, people talking about how they've dealt with COVID and isolation and the rest of it. And I thought that Alice and Meg's approach in particular kind of came at it from a different angle. Did you think that?
I agree. Yeah, they had a good conversation. I must admit, some small part of me is always thrilled when other people are saying they're not writing or finding writing very difficult in COVID. It's like I have this imaginary list of everyone in the world who's going to get a book out and I can just draw a line through that person's name for a little while.
We should find out the German word for that because I'm sure there is a German word for that.
German word.
That's so true.
But that idea of knowledge of an event before it occurs, I really, listening to Alice talk about the way she put it, I think was something like writing about something that researchers say could happen.
Yeah.
Which is such an interesting way to put it. So the knowledge exists and I imagine the process is a bit about understanding that and then using fiction as a device to imagine that world where those things are sort of all put together. But the counter to that is the difficulty we have in doing something about it.
Yeah.
So there's like a willingness to engage with it from a fiction perspective and for the act of storytelling. But, oh, God, action is a whole different ballgame.
It's a whole different ballgame. But I think, you know, I was saying I've had to answer questions about this recently and so I've been grappling with the same question, like in what way is writing about the fears and issues and the things that concern you, can you call that activism? Is it an act? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it is. But
well, I think it connects with people in a different way, doesn't it? Like that facts and figures approach is so.
I think so.
Is easier to ignore.
And, you know, in the case of both Alice and Meg's books, if if one of the things you can do is terrify people in fiction and urge them into action that way, maybe that is the way to go about it.
Now, I remember when Alice's book, The Glad Shout, first came out, I remember you having this moment of like, I think you had only read the blurb at this point, but you were like, oh, my God, she's written my book.
Yeah. Oh, like, my God. I sent her a message saying that. We talk about that in the interview that I'm like, oh, shit, Alice, I've written the same book as you, which is delightful in the fact that it also brought us together as writers and friends, but, you know, that's a fear too, isn't it, always, that not only someone else is writing a book right now and they're going to get their book out faster, but what if someone is writing the same book as me right now?
Brutal.
We can't afford to think about that. I loved how Alice said she always has a destination to write towards and a sense of the ending. Do you always know the ending you're writing towards, Catherine?
I think I have a sense of an ending is probably a good way to put it. I was thinking when these guys were talking about the end of the helpline, because I have had a number of people say to me, not what happened at the end, but being surprised by the end. And so one or two people were like, doesn't she change? Like, she doesn't change. And I remember thinking the point is not for her to change. The point is for you to understand her.
Yeah.
And for that to be okay. And so, yeah, interesting how you think about endings or reflect back on them once you've had interaction around them.
And also that endings are completely always divisive. And sometimes you're going for a divisive ending in the way that you are trying not to tie things up and resolve things too fully so that, you know,
I think Tony Jordan always talked about, which I think is a great way of putting it, that if an ending is happy, it has to be sort of mostly happy, a little bit sad. If an ending is sad, it has to be mostly sad, but there has to be a grain of hope.
Yeah.
Of course, that can go too far. I remember an author that I was with at Varuna the first time I went was writing a nonfiction book about her experience. Her sister had been killed by her husband. So the sister's husband had killed not only the sister, but also I think the parents as well. And so the nonfiction book was about the living author sort of reflecting back and unpacking what had happened and looking at court cases and all the rest. And I think the publisher had said to her when they'd gotten the copy of the manuscript, oh, do you think you could the end be a bit happier? Could you have a bit more positivity on the end note, which is pretty tough.
It's really tough. Mate, yeah, endings. The one other thing that I wanted to comment on was Meg talked about that idea of flow and the whole
act. This reminded me of you, this Meg.
Well,
talk.
Just that mysterious, you know, and characters acting out and outside of your control, and she talks about that being part of the joy, and that really resonated, and I think it's also what, certainly for me, it's what I chase. It's what I'm chasing the whole time, like the high of that, whether or not that comes on any given day or any given month or year.
It's a lovely feeling when it happens.
Yeah. But when
it happens. Do you ever forget to have lunch though?
I never forget to have coffee, but I do sometimes forget to have lunch, but definitely not coffee.
Last comment that I had was I do like collecting questions. And I reckon Alice asks a killer question, which is there something in your book, something you did in a craft sense that you recognised as pleasing? I really like that. That's back door of like, because sometimes you have these little things in your head that are so delightful to you for reasons you know but are never really apparent to anyone else. I think that's a great question.
Do you have one? A moment that is pleasing? Yeah, that's the other thing, is that it's actually a question that really requires notice.
It does.
Okay, get back to me next week.
Hi, Alice.
Hi, Meg. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's so nice to see you and to have this conversation, to get to have this conversation today. I've been thinking, like, I feel like there's two ways that we can start the conversation. One is that we could go back in time to, like, the beginning of things, and I want to hear all about your childhood and how you became a writer and all of that kind of thing. But or we could, you know, and this is a kind of question that always comes up when you're writing a book too, like, where do you start the narrative?
Yeah.
You know? Or we can just start, like, the more pressing or interesting way to start, I reckon, is, like, to talk about this weird moment that we're in and then go back. So I want to know about how you've survived in this time, this corona time, and like what impact that's having on your work.
Yeah, I think that is a really good place to start, like in the now. And that's how you and I met, right? Because we both, I mean, we did meet ages ago, but we're a bit confused about the how and where of that.
We actually don't agree on the way that we met at all.
Yeah.
You don't remember meeting me in the way that I had a really clear memory of meeting you. But anyway, it doesn't matter because this time has brought us back together and that's good.
Yeah, and the fact that we both had books come out, you know, within a period of time that have both been called prescient, and that's kind of been a bond for us, like going through watching our books come into the world, and what a strange world. So back to your question, how has this weird time affected my writing? Look, I haven't been able to do very much of it. The lockdown period was, I didn't mind being locked down because I'm a bit of a hermit, and I actually had more company than usual because I had my partner and son home with me. But the homeschooling was a nightmare. I became a horrendous crab, very cranky, and it was just a very high pressure thing. I was teaching and everything had moved online, so there was no space mentally or time wise to be writing anything much, apart from grant applications, of course, because it looked like the world was collapsing and how am I going to live? So it hasn't been a great time for writing, but I guess it's been a time of kind of sort of gathering and hunkering back down, and I feel like having that break from creative output, I'm now a little bit more raring to go. How about you? How's it been? How's writing fitted into this period for you?
When I think back on it, I mean, I had this really strange experience, which is that we moved from the country to the city. We've been living in regional Victoria for 8 years. And at that time, my husband and I, when we came back to Melbourne, we moved into separate apartments. So there was a kind of a rejigging of the family structure. So it was like I'd embarked on this whole new life in a new place, and I was just starting to feel a little bit okay about that, and then everything locked down. And so I went into that time, not really knowing who I was or what I was doing, and it was like every part of my life had somehow changed, and it was kind of out of control. Which, when I reflect back on what that period of time was like when I was working at home and the kids were at home with me a lot of the time, but it wasn't even really a home that I related to because I'd only just arrived there. It was a pretty dark time mentally. And a part of the darkness of that was that I found it really hard to think clearly. I couldn't marshal my thoughts. And in fact, the only other time I've really felt like that was in the early years of parenthood, like with newborn babies, when you're really, the rug's just been ripped out from under you and you just can't, I just couldn't seem to grapple with anything or grip onto anything, any frameworks to make sense of what was happening in my life personally or in the world. And that's very discombobulating. But the good thing is, if a good thing can come out of it in work-wise, that the novel that I'm writing at the moment sort of draws on some of these experiences. And I was just trying to work out what kind of disaster or framework, because, you know, I'm still interested in apocalypse and disaster and these kinds of other big narrative arcs that can happen in novels that the characters' personal lives can hang off. And I was just trying to work out what it might be that would fit with the kind of story I'm trying to tell now. And it was like the pandemic came along and it just fits so perfectly as a kind of a structure, at least it does for this draft. Who knows what will happen? So that was kind of helpful in that sense, in a writing sense. But it was such a strange time. I don't even know if I've had the chance to really understand what that was like to be in that apartment with the kids for those months.
Yeah, that's really weird because, there was the idea of kind of retreating to home ground, but yet it probably wasn't a home yet for you because it was still just a house. You hadn't formed memories and attachments and you know, probably wasn't integrated with the inside and the outside, suddenly we just bang, like this different configuration. That must have been so strange. But did you actually manage to continue writing through that despite the discombobulation and the confusion and the, you know, it must have been really hard.
I did do a little bit of writing and, like, I managed to keep working in a kind of not particularly productive way, but it was something to cling on to. And I think that's the other thing that in these times in my life, like early parenthood, like this time, which has been pretty hard in its own way, writing has offered a through line, both a way of making sense of time, like, okay, the kids are in bed now, rather than facing this yawning kind of evening alone, I've got something, a really productive thing that I can apply myself to, and that's very meaningful. And it also offers a way of making sense of what's happening in some way, of processing what's going on, and I really value that. I often think of other people who don't write or make something, you know, who aren't artists in some way. I wonder what they get up to in the evenings.
I don't know. I mean, they probably watch TV. I mean, I watch TV, I must say. That's how I switch off my brain. But it has to be good TV. I have to be getting some pleasure out of the way it's put together visually or narrative-wise. But maybe people do stuff, I don't know, people read. Yes. I hope they read. Maybe they make model aircraft or they, you know, do other things that are creative, like gardening, or you can't really garden at night. Okay. I don't know. I can't imagine not having that outlet, and that, I guess the way you've put it was fantastic, a way for sort of processing life and making sense of it through this weird activity of putting black marks on a white page. I can't imagine not being something that's there and always an option.
Yes, like this little meaningful thing on the side that's what you're always carrying with you, that you can just kind of, like a touchstone. I always think, you know, no matter what else is going on, I've got this kind of secret meaningful thing that's kind of sustaining me in some way. And maybe no one else will care about it, and that's okay because it's helping me.
Yeah, even just knowing it's there is important, isn't it? Even if you're not actually doing it at the moment, you're not able to. You know, you might see your book on a bookshelf in your house, or you might see a notebook, or you might just notice something strange that happens between two people walking down the street, avoiding each other because they don't want to get germs. And you're just constantly, you're never really off, are you? Like, it's all kind of going in here and adding to the beautiful compost heap. So it is a real treat having that, isn't it? I haven't really thought about it that way before. It's like a little secret cave where you can do magic.
Yes. I wanted to ask you, because we're talking about all of this, you know, in terms of your latest novel, which is so, you know, it was prescient in a way that I don't think, like, was that, I think I've heard you say that it actually isn't that astounding, because if you've done the kind of research you've done about pandemics, this is kind of a foregone conclusion almost. But that must, I mean, I think I said to you that when the Glad Shout came out, I often felt the need to kind of scream, like, I already wrote about this, you know, when things are going wrong in the world. And of course you don't do that because you don't want to sound like a massive wanker. But really weird about it, you know, when you think, like, I imagine this and now it's happening. It's so strange. So tell me about that feeling for you.
It was super strange. I mean, you're right. I should speak about The Trespassers is set mostly on a ship, and bad things happen on the ship, and the ship is full of migrants and they're coming to Australia, and it's in the near future. So a couple of things. Yes, virologists and epidemiologists have been warning for a long time that, you know, Ebola and SARS and H1N1, that was a glimpse of what was coming, and we were going to be facing, you know, major pandemics in the future. So because I love doing research, and I thought, well, what's the future going to look like? And that was one of the things that came up. But the actual genesis or the anchor point of the story is historical. So, and that was like 1852, a ship that came over from, a migrant labour ship that came over from the UK, and it was a tragedy. It was called the Ticonderoga. And so many people died. I think it was like 170 passengers and crew died because of that journey, because there was typhus and scarlet fever let loose in this enclosed space. So I really borrowed from history, but also from the future. But it was very weird that the book went out into the world and then we had this pandemic come. And at first I thought, oh yeah, there's a pandemic. That's what all the experts said was going to happen. And then we started getting messages from friends saying, have you seen that there's like ships full of people stuck and nobody wants the people to get off the ship, and it's all been handled badly and the government's very awkward. And that was eerie and spooky. And that was happening at this, you know, initial stage of the lockdown. I went into lockdown a little bit early because of my research, I kind of knew what was coming and I wanted to stay away from it because I'm immune compromised myself. And so there's a lot of hand washing, a lot of very dry hands going on, which is also what happened when I was writing the book. But it was so unreal and eerie, Alice. Like, I'd go for a walk at night sometimes and the streets were empty, deserted, and I felt like I was walking through a fictional landscape, some dystopian, eerie. Everything looked like a parallel reality. It is shifted into another realm. And at times I'd think, is this real? Am I having a dream? You know, it started to blur.
It's some part of you, like, when I had that experience also, just in terms of, like, thinking the world is so surreal right now, or other. It's not familiar. And as I was saying, that happened inside my house, but also in the landscape. But some part of me, and I think this is a common feeling maybe, felt like this is actually an improved world in some ways. And I don't mean to diminish the tragedy of the corona for other people, but in Melbourne, where we've been relatively protected from the worst effects of the actual virus, and the kind of actual impact of it was mostly that we just had to stay home and the streets were empty and all of those things, in some ways there was something very calm about all of that and nice in some way.
Yeah, it was like taking a breath. It was like a quiet spot, like the hubbub died down and the noise died down, and if you could sit comfortably with that, it was a time where, I mean, when you weren't frantically trying to school your child and do your job and, you know, wipe down your groceries or however we were all handling it, there was a sense of kind of calmness and kind of gathering in and perhaps regrouping.
But Meg, I want to ask you also, just before, like, I forget this question, when you're talking about the book being historical and also, like, kind of imagining a future that's already been predicted, and then we had corona, does it make you feel like we as humans can learn from history or no?
I think we're particularly bad at learning from history at the moment, because we cordon it off, and we're living in a culture of continuous surface chatter and recycling. And I'm talking about, I guess, social media. Not everyone's on Twitter, and I don't particularly like Twitter, but the way that news and information is shared and communicated today has just been these massive shifts. And even, you know, we have this horrendous president who actually uses Twitter as a way of his primary communication with the world. So there's not a lot of space in that environment for reflecting back and putting things into context. I think, and it's kind of artificial, because history, I mean, yesterday's history, right? like 5 minutes ago is history, but we kind of go, oh, that's history. Things are different now. But as we see, like, things cycle, things turn and things repeat themselves. But we're too caught in the moment, I think. We don't really, like, want to learn from that.
Oh, you go.
Oh, hold that thought, though. I wondered also with your, when you were writing The Glad Shout, were you ever writing it when there was a storm happening? Did you become more conscious of the weather? Like, I'm kind of thinking about, you know, like climate stuff and that other crisis that we're also in the midst of. Mm. And, you know, the potential for collapse to be a lot closer than we think it is. How conscious of that were you when you were actually writing the book? And then when the bushfires hit earlier this year, I'm interested in what it was like to be you in that moment.
I think my memory of writing The Glad Shout is pretty distorted because I wrote it when I had these two little babies, and my memory of writing it is that this kind of, it was both a tricky thing and also an unburdening, because I thought, like, I'm really under the pump here. I've got like a one-year-old and a three-year-old. It was actually just very insular in my head. So I wasn't doing a lot of field research or any kind of research. I was just making it up, basically. Mm. But so in that sense, it felt a little bit disconnected from the real world. And I was just working on imagination primarily. But with Anchor Point, the first novel that had come out of a lot of research that I did for my PhD, and I'd been writing that book at the time of the Black Saturday fires, or the early research was taking place in 2009 when those big fires happened, and that was really eerie and a sense of sort of prescience, or a sense of like, oh, what I'm writing about isn't just theoretical. It's like, it's, you know, the things that the researchers are saying can really happen, just like what you're saying about the pandemic. But I am really interested in, and I still am interested in, this connection between history and the future. Like the way that if you look back in time, you know, these big fires, for example, have been happening in Australia forever. And we've had other royal commissions about bushfire and how we should behave with them and things. But it's like each generation has to relearn this information about place. In a way that potentially, like, we shouldn't need to. We should be more kind of grounded in this place and understanding of its the way that it operates. The thing with The Glad Shout, though, in that sense, is that I remember writing, feeling very angry a lot of the time when I was writing it. And part of that was a sense of, like, cultural inertia about climate change. Like, why isn't anyone doing it? I'm not particularly well-versed in any of that stuff. Mm. And, you know, I'm not a scientist or any of that stuff. It didn't take much to just imaginatively connect a few dots to think this could happen here. So why is it so hard for people to come to terms with all of this? And I think there's a passage in the book that talks about this idea, you know, like our grandparents lived through depression, like people we know have been through war, there have been other disasters, all of this stuff has already happened here or somewhere. So yeah, in that sense, the sense of surprise or horror, or, you know, is legitimate but kind of confusing to me, because it's already, I always carry this sense of like, I'm forewarned because I've thought about these issues and the dots are connected in my head. But what am I doing to forearm myself about these things if they are to come to pass here? And the answer is I'm doing nothing. And that really worries me.
Yeah. Look, I think that what you've pointed out, that kind of turning away, or that sort of knowing it but not acting on it, or not learning lessons from even recent history, I think it's partly that as human beings, we do turn away from horror and we want to feel safe, and so we think, oh, it's over the horizon, you know, or that was a special situation. You know, it wouldn't happen to me. Of course, if you're one of the people who lost a loved one in the bushfire, or lost your home in the bushfire, that's a different that's a different situation. That must bring it home in a different way. But for the rest of us, for the rest of humankind, I think in order to survive, we kind of muddle along in a state of willful ignorance, partly so that we don't become overwhelmed. But that doesn't help us to solve the very real problems that are bubbling just beneath the surface and can come up at any time. And I think another thing is the political system that we've got is geared towards, it's a short-term cycle of, you know, elections and all the sloganeering, and it doesn't really leave a lot of room for reflecting back and drawing patterns out of a longer term narrative, apart from, I won't go into how corrupt and disgraceful it is, but I think that also plays into it, that sort of let's not think about that, let's distract ourselves with something else.
Also, one of the beautiful things about fiction that I really enjoy is that you can line up all of these, you know, time can become a really elastic in a narrative, a fictional narrative, where you can line up these different events and they can be side by side, whereas in history they're like hundreds of years apart potentially. You know, it's so powerful and beautiful to be able to do that.
Yeah, actually, that's a really interesting point. And that was something that with The Trespassers, I did consciously do that. I pulled little bits, little snippets, little images from here and there, even from the Children Overboard scandal, and sort of wove them in together, I guess. And that freedom was quite intoxicating, isn't it? You can borrow from this timeline, you can borrow from this place, and then kind of weave them together. And I don't know about you, but I'm never quite sure actually what I'm doing when I'm doing it. It's only later that you go, oh, yeah, of course I was trying to bring these things together in order to say something. But at the time, I get so immersed in the task itself that maybe some of the broader themes are subconsciously knitting together as I'm writing. What about you? What does it feel like when you're actually doing the work, like knocking out the words?
When writing's going really well for me, it's like, and this can only happen in really small amounts of time. I've never had it for hours. You know, as people say, I just sat down at my desk and I forgot to eat lunch and all of this stuff. That's never happened to me. I'm like thinking, oh my God.
Really?
Hours gone past. No, only 2 minutes have gone past. But, you know, there are moments where it goes really well where I feel that I've entered a kind of an altered state of mind. I'm not a very good note taker or diarist or anything like that. So I come to the work without any backup, really, any notes or anything, just a sense of the story and the characters. And often with all the two books I've published and the one that I'm working on now, I've always had a sense of the ending already, like a destination that I'm trying to get to. But when it's going really well, I feel like I go into this altered state and I'm able to access memory or ideas or place or details that I just couldn't think like just now and jot them down. Something to do with the process unearths them. Yeah. And then it's so pleasing because when I stand up from the desk at the end of that, I think, wow, like I never thought of that before. Like it's come out of the act of doing the work. And I don't even know if that is a sensible thing to say. To me, it's a feeling or something. It's an emotional kind of connection to something. You're trying to explain something that's invisible almost. Yeah. So it's really hard to articulate.
Oh, look, I can absolutely, that completely resonates with me. I am one of those people who will forget to eat lunch and perhaps leave the bath running and flood the house. That's happened a few times. But, I mean, yeah, I think there's a person with an unpronounceable name. I think it's like Csikszentmihalyi or something, who came up with the idea of flow, that when you're engaged and fully immersed in an activity, and I think it could be something like gardening or whatever, but it really resonates for artists and writers, that you do lose a sense of time and a sense of your own ego and And this stuff is like almost like conjuring, like it kind of comes up and you don't know where it's come from. It's so weird and mysterious, and the characters do things that you didn't, it's almost like you didn't tell them to do that, you know. It's and I think for me that's part of the joy of it, the unexpected things that emerge as you're sitting there with your fingers on this plastic keyboard of this machine. Like, where does this stuff come from? I'm interested that you say that you have a sense of the ending, because I normally don't, because I partly want to be surprised, but sometimes I can see a little bit ahead and that gives me a little point to go to. But do you ever find that you have an ending in mind and then it changes, or do you usually find your way to the ending that you have envisaged, however fuzzily?
Sometimes with the glad chat and the and anchor point, it was only one line, so there was lots of room for movement, but it was like I was aiming at a little like aesthetic moment almost more than a plot point or something.
Oh,
like that.
Nice.
I think it changes so much. I think it's frustrating for my publisher, because there's a sense that if you knew what you were doing, you could do it more quickly or you know, more effectively. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard. I just find it hard, connected to what I was saying before, to imagine the story without being in the process. Like, the process is giving rise to the thing. Like, to conceive of it cold in some way, it's like trying to describe a dance without doing the dance. It's like, well, my feet would go here. Like, to me, that would be, it seems very a dry way to approach something that's kind of bodily. And sometimes when I'm at my computer and I'm writing, I almost feel like a pianist. Like, and my body's moving and the hands are on the keys in this kind of rhythmical way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That completely resonates with me too. And also with the idea that when you're making this thing, you're aware of patterns, right? You make a nice sentence that has a nice music on the page, and maybe the next sentence is a different phrase, or it's got and that's so that completely resonates with me. It's almost like you're putting together a piece of music, and then when you're editing, you're kind of like rearranging the patterns so that it has a pleasing or dramatic effect on the page. Yeah, I really like that idea. I'm not very good at the piano, but I really like that idea. That's really cool. And also the idea of something flowing through you that is not entirely under your control.
Meg, I wanted to ask you as well, though, just before we get off the topic of the books, is there something in your book, like a craft, something you did from a craft-based perspective that you might recognise as really pleasing to you because maybe you hadn't done it before or tried it before and maybe readers wouldn't even notice, but is there something that you feel really proud of about it?
Well, I'm quite proud of the fact that I actually managed to get plot right in this one, I think, because I've always struggled with plot, because I think what you're saying in a sense is that you're also a bit of a pantser, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, and that when you do have a sense of the ending, it's a line or a moment or an image rather than a neat and tidy resolution. But in this book, I tried to stretch myself and go, all right, I really struggle with plot. It's not my strong point. But in this book, I feel like I got better at plot, and I tried to sort of write something that was a bit of a page turner, but literary. And so, yeah, I'm quite proud of the way I managed to handle something that I had always sort of struggled with a bit. And I'm less frightened of it now, because I know that you can go back and you can put pieces in that then connect the dots later on. So I guess that would be something. And also, like, I like some of the symbolism in there that's not, probably nobody else noticed, but I put it in because it gave me pleasure, you know. What about you? What about in the glad chat? Was there something that you did craft-wise that you...
You're saying about plus?
Pardon? Craft, sorry? Yeah.
I really relate to what you're saying about plot. I feel the same way. And I wonder if that's quite common for literary writers. Like when I started writing, originally it was poetry. And so and there was image and metaphor and language, really. And to move from there to be able to write a book like The Glad Chat, which I really focused on the plot. And part of that, I guess, is thinking about the reader more and what might be pleasurable for them. But the thing that actually, the moment that I'm really proud of that no one else would even pick up on is I just had this sense of writing The Glad Chat at times, like that I could put in things that people had actually said. Like a more cool, I think, you know, I was always writing colloquial dialogue, but this sense of a sense of kind of truth or something about how people speak, or some moments in that book where I'm like, this actually happened. I didn't have to make it up, or it was kind of close to the truth. And it really pleased me to be able to write it down. And I thought, oh, that's how you do it. You just observe a moment and you put it in the book. Obvious, like, but it's sort of mind blowing to me that you didn't have to invent everything, you know. And I really, I still like those moments in the book, even though no one else would know that they're there. Or
I really love that. And I guess it comes back to the idea that when you're walking around and you're just doing life, all of that is kind of going in there into the compost heap. And it's a beautiful idea that you can just take something out, even just a line or something that you saw or an interaction, and just pop that into the story. It's like free treasure.
Yeah. Right? Beautiful way to think about it. We I don't know if we've got very much more time, but before we finish up, I wondered what you thought about how your child sees what you do.
Oh, Charlie, he just thinks it's normal, I guess. He reads a lot. He's a huge reader, which is really awesome. Even before he could read, he would be, you know, doing those horrible air quotes, reading in bed. But he was just turning the pages and looking at the pictures, and he'd get cross if I want to turn the light off. So he's very much into reading. His writing, he wants to be a robot engineer. So I think he's safe from the downside of the writing life. But I guess he just takes it for granted. He was at my book launch and he was excited. He wanted to launch the book himself, but he was only six, so I didn't let him do that. Or maybe he was five at the time. But I mean, every so often you'll get something in the paper and they've put a photo of you or something, and he just sees that and he's like, yeah, whatever. But he doesn't. He doesn't care. He likes hearing me on the radio sometimes, but it's just normal for him. He doesn't think it's weird. What he doesn't like is that I'm at my desk a lot and that he's not supposed to come and bug me when I'm at my desk. But then again, when he was really little, he got a box and set it up. He was like three or something, and I could see that he was typing, you know. So he was sort of testing it out. So that was really cute. What about you? What about your kids? How do they, how old are they?
They're 5 and 7 at the moment, nearly 6 and 8. The bigger one has got this kind of interesting attitude of like, oh, reading and writing, that's your thing, Mum.
All right.
Which I find utterly heartbreaking, of course, but I think it's probably just a, you know, part of differentiating in childhood. Yeah. But the interesting thing to me about my children is that they've got each other. I was an only child, like your son. So I think reading and writing are a natural fit for someone who doesn't have another child in the house, because they're great to do their own. They're actually solitary activities. So they're But my two kids are quite close in age and they have each other. So their imaginative world happens between them. And I, weirdly, as the parent, and especially as a person who grew up as an only child who've always wanted to have kids, in some ways I've put myself out of a job by having the two of them, because their primary relationship in some ways is with each other. And their play and their kind of imaginations take place. And I'm a bit of an interloper in that in some ways, which is interesting. One of the most pleasing moments was a day that I picked the kids up from school, and and we got in the car and I turned on the ignition and the radio just came on, you know, when it had been on, and when you turn the key, it launches into life. And it was a playback of an interview with me. And so, and I just thought, it was just the weird timing of that. It was on ABC. And, you know, the kids didn't particularly find it special or interesting, which was interesting to me, but just the kind of the thing of them sort of bearing witness to the fact that women and mothers can do these kinds of things and their voices can be heard and broadcast. I just thought, yes, that's just so lovely. And I'm really proud of myself and in that respect that I've given them that insight.
That's a beautiful moment. I love that kind of serendipity. And yeah, I hadn't really thought of it before, but for kids to see women having a voice and being out there and being part of a public conversation, I think it's really valuable, you know, both for girls and for boys to see that, you know. What do your kids have? Do they have like, I'm going to be blah, blah when I grow up? Do they?
No, I think the little one wants to be a soccer player. So it's a great fun though, being a parent. And it, you know, it's really informed a lot of my work. They say amazing things, these guys.
I know, it does, doesn't it? I take my hat off to you. I take my whole head off to you writing a book with two young children. That's just formidable. I barely got through it with one. Like that's incredible. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to downplay it. I mean, a lot of people aren't parents, and they, you know, their writing is like just as rich. But I know what you mean. It's given me a great sort of tools. Even just that idea of getting down on the ground and being at the child's level, it's really helped me with writing child characters. Just, you know, having recently gone through the thing where you're in a playground and you're little and the world looks different, like I found that really great in terms of empathy and inhabiting little characters.
When you think about your own childhood, can you see any like precursor or any like big moments that or it's clues that you would have become a writer?
Oh yeah, I was a weird little kid. I had a sister, so we used to play together a lot, but we also would squabble, you know, we were quite close in age. So we actually did used to make up stories together, and we had the little tape recorder and we'd interview each other and pretend to be newsreaders or whatever. So that she's also a very creative person. She's a scientist now, but she's an artist, she paints. But I had imaginary friends. I don't know if you had them. Like they all had to wash their hands. I fed them grass and on my teacup set. I thought that I was a man called Rowan when I was three and I made people call me Rowan. I was a man with a beard who rowed a boat down a stream and that was just normal. Like that was my alter ego and there was nothing weird about that. And, you know, I'd go off by myself for long periods of time and just lose myself on kind of nature and weird and make spells and stuff. So yeah, there was all that kind of weird creative stuff going on that signaled either a future of serious mental illness or a life spent writing stories. What about you?
I think, yeah, going back to the being the only child, I've always loved reading and I think it was, you know, an escape and also a way of... I remember my dad saying to me when I was a child, you know, if you can read, you can go anywhere you want, you know, anywhere in the world, anywhere in time, you're never bored.
Yeah.
And that was so true. And I think also, you know, it's interesting to me because, I loved Anne of Green Gables and Jo March, you know, Little Women. These two, like, kind of formidable, clever women who grew up to be writers, but they're both, like, you know, 19th century or, you know, like, it was just interesting. So these two women, because they weren't contemporary, but they were really kind of ballsy in their ambition, really formed a sense of, like, possibility for what women can be. But also they had that romantic kind of quality about them, which really also informed my character in some ways.
But, yeah. I read those books as well when I was young and they made a really strong impression on me as well, although I didn't really place them firmly in the past. I didn't really have that context for them, but my grandmother gave me Anne of Green Gables and Yeah, it was. And I also remember To Kill a Mockingbird, I remember Scout. I remember really loving Scout as a character when I was a kid. And she wasn't a writer, but there was just, I guess I saw something of myself in her, and that was the sort of way into stories as well, that you could sort of be inside a character. But yeah, I love that thing that your dad said. I think that's so beautiful and such a beautiful thing to remind a child about. Like, we had a big bookshelf too that I would always, I remember the smell of it, I was always like looking at my parents' books and choosing inappropriate books. So that was really lucky. That was really lucky as well, I think, you know, because so many kids don't grow up with that. And I wonder how much harder it is for them to...
I'm sure that I've seen research that says that if you grow up in a house with books, even if they're not being read to you or you don't pick them up, you know, in a concerted way, your rate of literacy or education or success, I can't remember what the measure was, but is much higher, which makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
It would be indicative of a whole lot of things about what's going on in the family, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought that was a really lovely idea. You just have to have books around you and around kids and everything will be okay.
Yeah, it's almost like they kind of, they leak out by osmosis. I mean, there's probably, you know, correlational stuff there too around poverty and education levels that also play into. But I do love the idea that just like they're almost like magic objects. If they're around, they're gonna leech some kind of goodness into you and feed your imagination in some way or another.
What are you working on now, Meg?
Well, my next book's going to be nonfiction. I want to try something different. So I haven't actually started it yet, but it's in my mind and it's ticking over. And I just got some good news that I'm not allowed to share. That means that I am going to actually officially start it very, very soon. And that's going to be like a kind of narrative work of, I guess, like populist psychology and like lots of interviews and looking at stigma and prejudice and creative ways that might be reversed or upturned. And it's kind of around homelessness. It's around the hostility that's directed in Australia towards people who've been homeless. And like, I want to interview neuroscientists and, you know, virtual reality researchers and think about, oh wow, how could some of this misinformation and hostility and stigma be, well, it's a creative way that it could be flipped around and turned into something that's more productive and compassionate and informed. So, yeah, I usually superstitious about talking about things before I am writing them, but this is not fiction, so I feel less frightened of doing that.
Amazing. I can't wait to read it. What a great idea.
Thank you. And how far in are you? Like, did you just start writing straight away after you finished
I've been working on it like very slowly for a year. I think, but I think I've said this before, but I feel like I really didn't make any concessions in my head for how grueling that year would be after the Glad Chat came out. And I didn't have to contend with Corona. So I was massively privileged. This is all happening in 2019. I just didn't set anything up in my life to prepare for just how much it would be to manage the book stuff on top of work and family. But I also had in my head, like with between the Glad Shout and Anchor Point, the first book, it took me a long time to get going on the Glad Shout. And I just thought maybe a way of dealing with, there's a lot of anxiety after you publish a book about what's going to happen. Will anyone read it? Will anyone care? You know, I don't know. And just to grapple with that, I thought it's good to just start something else so that you're not fixated on what's happening with the other one.
That's so true, because that fixation is like, I mean, I haven't let go of it yet. And you have to do so much sort of spruiking, and it's great. You keep get engaged in conversations around it, but it's a huge amount of work, and it can be quite anxiety provoking. Because you do wonder, is anyone reading this? Is it gonna make an impact on the world? Is it gonna make any difference? Is it gonna make my career any more sustainable than it is? Possibly not. but I like that idea that getting started on the next book is a good a good distraction from that, all of that kind of
it just keeps anxiety. You centered in the work. The work is what it's about, not the apparatus around it. That's what I'm trying to stay focused on anyway. But progress is very slow for all the reasons we've talked about.
Yeah.
And that's okay too. So part of it is just about making peace with like how long it all takes. And it's okay. Yeah.
It's huge, isn't it? And I think that's what you've hit upon. I mean, the magic of it is going into that cave and doing the conjuring and that's kind of transformative in itself, and it's sustaining, even though it's bloody hard work and it takes forever. It's really important, I guess, to remind ourselves that it's not just about external recognition or what happens afterwards. It's actually being a writer is actually doing the writing and making the thing, the process itself. And yeah, I think that's a good way to temper the anxiety, is to remind ourselves of that.
I think that's also a really beautiful note to end on. I don't think we can say anything more profound and beautiful than that. That's so lovely. I'm gonna carry that into the weekend with me and try and do a little bit of work and think about that. It's beautiful.
Ah, beautiful. Thanks, Alice. Well, we have come to the Zoom's about to cut us off. So it was so beautiful to talk to you, and I want us to sit down, eat a meal together once all of this, you know, it's a bit less scary to do that. I'm still a bit nervous about it, but
we will. We'll do, definitely.
Yeah,
do.
Yeah. I hope you feel better soon. Take a bit of a rest this weekend. Get some sunshine. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Love, Meg. I'll speak to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons. This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.